The hotel business is really, really hard. It's incredibly hard. It's an operating business. And just because the person you're buying it from might be unsophisticated, might be a mom and pop, might be a little old school, doesn't mean they didn't try to do some of the things that you're doing. So don't assume that everything that you think is low-hanging fruit can be easily achieved. They might have tried that and failed. They might have failed for reasons that they had no control over. So you want to try and figure that out. You want to ask a lot of questions, and you don't want to prepay for ideas that may not come to fruition. All right, who's ready to do this? Coming in, finish the year strong. Good to see some familiar faces. Thanks for jumping on. I've got kind of a tight schedule today, so I'm going to get through some stuff that I think is really interesting right now and wanted to share with all of you. And then we'll leave time for some questions as well. So please keep that in mind. If a question comes up, feel free to just write it down, take a note, and we can go into it. I do some of this one-on-one coaching, and it's been a lot of fun. I've learned a lot. I've helped a lot of other people, and it has been really inspiring to see what people have done with what we've talked about, what we've learned, and put actionable strategies in place. So if this is something you want to do, it's really expensive, but you'll get me for 30 minutes, for an hour, for 2 hours. We can figure out something else if that works, but you can kind of book it initially just right on my website. So I wanted to point that out. And also, don't forget to tune into the podcast, because this is like free information. I just recorded one today. It is awesome. We have a lot of hotel people, a lot of real estate people. I have learned so much. I hope you guys are learning a lot as well. If you're not tuned in, check out Masters of Moments. What I want to talk about today is basically converting a mom and pop motel, probably in a resort area, into something cool, into a lifestyle hotel, into a hotel that's going to lead the market in ADR. And the reason why I want to talk about something existing is because a lot of these beach markets have motels with some great architecture. And a lot of the architecture now, particularly in hospitality, is terrible. It all looks commoditized. And hotels and motels from a certain time had a certain vibe and a certain thing that I think should be celebrated. And people will continue to celebrate it. And there are some of these hidden gems found in some of these areas. And I think there are some really interesting opportunities to turn some of these around. So I'm going to highlight, here's what we're going to talk about: converting them, how you have to think about it, how you have to program the new hotel, what the renovation scope and plans might look like, what amenities you need to think about. Because the people that develop these crappy little motels, they weren't thinking about how you think and how I think and how people are traveling today. So we need to jazz these things up if they're going to be viable. This is not your mom and pop's motel. This is something new and special. Talk about the potential risks, how to underwrite the deal, and some operational considerations. So just to kick it off, okay, I think there are some examples that you can stay at, that you can experience, that are just unbelievable, that are kicking ass, that I want to point out to you in case you are not aware. This one is called Sunset Beach. It is in Shelter Island, New York, which is the Hamptons. It was created by Andre Balas, who owns the Chateau Marmont in West Hollywood, a real amazing hospitality guy. He also owns Chiltern Firehouse in London. He was kind of like the founder of Standard Hotels, really amazing properties. And let me tell you, this thing is anchored by some amazing food and beverage. It's right on the beach. It has an amazing location, which is key. We'll talk about that. And it does really well. It's a mainstay. It's sold out for the entire summer. Very, very cool property. Another one, the Standard Hotel in Miami Beach was a motel. I think it might have been a nursing home. I remember I was in college and a friend of mine had the opportunity to buy it, I think for like $10 million or something. Back then, he owned a bunch of hotels in Miami Beach. He was thinking about it. This thing is waterfront on the bay. The architecture is iconic. The setup is iconic. It has one of the best pool scenes in Miami Beach. But if you looked at this thing in any other market, you'd be like, it's like a crappy little motel building. But they have done it right. The landscaping is out of control. The interior design is great. But the rooms are simple. And it was also done by Andre Balas, similar to Sunset Beach and Shelter Island. And if you look at those rooms, if you go Google those rooms, they are pretty basic. Here's like the little coffee shop in Standard Miami Beach, super vibey. Interesting note, you know, one of the best hotel investors out there, Barry Sternlicht, bought this hotel during COVID. He stole it. The family that owned Zara, I think, owned the hotel. And the deal came to him. He was able to move quick. And they had just spent a ton of money renovating the hotel. And the NOI wasn't that great. He came in, improved the asset management. I think he took over the management as well from Standard. I think they do it in-house. They really ramped up the NOI, like insane. And now the hotel is probably worth 2 to 3 times what he paid for it. They're going to build a condo now. One of the biggest home run deals to come out of COVID and an amazing hotel. It's just the vibe is awesome. It's not like what you'd think of as traditional luxury. It's not luxury. Here's the room, okay? But the landscape, the whole setup, all the amenities are great. And then here's another hotel, High Country Motor Lodge. Buddy of mine, John Grossman, I think he was episode number 2 on the podcast, did this hotel. He took a Howard Johnson, okay? You can see this is a crappy Howard Johnson. He painted it. He put in a really cool lobby. He automated the front desk and the check-in system. He put these little cottages and cabins. He did amazing FF&E, amazing design. John is a great hotelier, some fabulous properties. He is crushing his competitive set. And it just, something about these motels move people. They want to stay there. They want to be a part of it. It's nostalgic. People like it. It's better than new. So he does such a good job. And what he did with the interiors, go Google it online. High Country Motor Lodge is really exceptional. But he took this crappy Howard Johnson box. And I remember he talked about on the podcast, he's like, we didn't have enough money to fully redo the bathrooms. So we kind of made it work. And that's something you have to think about as well. And one of the best pieces of advice John has ever given me, it was on the podcast, when you're doing these historic renovations, yes, when you're renovating one of these motels, okay, look how they look on the outside. Don't fight the building. That's what he said. Don't fight the building. Embrace what the building offers, but it's got to have some decent architecture. And again, location, location, location is very key. So let's move on to just like how you would consider doing this. And I think one of the most important things is what market you are going to think about even doing this in. It has to be a market where there is leisure demand. Doesn't have to be a resort market. I think a resort market's great. If you have an all year round leisure demand market, great. There has to be a cool crowd that goes to this market. I think these should be drive to destinations. So this should be no more than 2.5 hours from a major city. If it has airlift, that's great. But location, location, location is key. I think if you are going to do this in the middle of nowhere, no F&B, it might be a little hard because you're going to have to keep everyone there and you're going to have to keep the demand going and you're going to have to create all these experiences. It might be tough, but if you're going to be at the entrance to a national park, If you're going to be beachfront, if you're going to be across from the beach, if you're going to be the beach town, if you're going to be in a beautiful wooded area where there's tons of hiking, I think you can get away with like a cute town. I think you can get away with doing it. They're very hard to figure out because a lot of them are owned by mom and pops. They've been in a family for a while and they're owned by very typically unsophisticated sellers. So negotiating a deal is going to be challenging. In fact, we were negotiating a deal up until today. Maybe we're still going to get it for one in a market in Cape Cod. And the sellers have such an unrealistic expectation of what their property is worth because they think the land is very valuable. Well, let me tell you something. The land is only worth what the business is producing in income. Unless I'm going to scrap the whole thing and build a bunch of residential, which I'm not, and you can't. So the land is only worth what the business can produce. And it's great. People will love to tell you all the good ideas I have. Well, if it was so easy, why didn't they do it? So getting into these things at a basis that works is very, very, very important. Because at the end of the day, you're buying a 1960s, 1970s hotel, which is motel, which is going to need a lot of work. Okay? It's going to need a lot of work. And you cannot let the seller take all of your upside. So basis is really important. Location is incredibly important. I think the aesthetics of the building are also incredibly important. You have to think about that. And also enhancing the aesthetics for not a lot of money. Landscaping usually can always be enhanced at these properties and is always a huge opportunity. So if you're looking at one of these properties and you have a small landscape budget, you're either in the middle of the woods or you're not underwriting it properly because the rooms are pretty small. They usually lack significant amenities because these were small buildings. There's not a lot of interior lobby space and different spaces. So you're going to have to enhance the outside. Maybe there's a pool. Maybe you do a Nordic spa like John did. Maybe you build a beautiful patio or deck under a big tree and put a little bar out there. Maybe you can add a little hut for meetings and little corporate events and little retreats. That could be cool. You have to think about what you can do. Maybe add a pickleball court or a padel court. You have to think about what you can do with the land, how you can enhance the land. But the best and cheapest way always is to just landscape the heck out of something. And with these hotels, there's always a ton of opportunity. Motels, there's always a ton of opportunity to do that. And I would encourage everyone to really over allocate to the landscaping budget. The other thing you need to think about from a building standpoint is what can I do to the building? Can I add on top of it? If it's a single story, can you add another story? If there's a very small lobby, can you add an annex with a little bar and a restaurant? Can you add a patio? If there's no pool, can you add a pool? These are the kind of things that really need to be thought through because, again, these hotels were built like a motor lodge with no amenities. Speaking of motor lodge, parking is a big consideration. So in this one that we were looking at in Cape Cod, you know, there's tons of asphalt everywhere because people drive their cars. There's a missed opportunity on the landscape side. Well, let me tell you something. A lot of people are driving less. You might be in a drive-to market, but doesn't mean everyone drives there. So maybe you need less parking spots. And who wants to park their car right in front of your like room? Like that's not cool. Maybe unless you're in Texas and the guy likes looking at his bed or looking at his truck from laying in his bed out the window. But if you're in one of these resort markets, keep the cars away, over landscape. There's an amazing hotel. They did a great job called the Maram in Montauk. It's the same thing. The conversion of a I'm going to pull it up real quick. It was the conversion of a motel, and it ended up being bought by KSL for an insane price per key. And these guys just made a old school beachfront hotel, motel, look cool, exterior corridors. They spent a lot of money though. I'm going to bring up some pictures so you can see what I'm talking about. So you can see this, it's great. Look at the bathrooms, super nice, this timeless design, great pool. But listen, this was the existing pool. They built this deck. You see the different two shades of wood? So that's what I'm talking about, being creative with what you've got, spending dollars that made sense. This little area was like a parking lot. See, they built a little bar out there, a little patio. They put some sand. They over-landscaped everything. They have some rooms with bunk beds, which are kind of fun. Very minimal food and beverage. Just great, great, great design. They cladded the whole building. I think they went a little overboard. Actually, so all of these areas in front of these guest rooms here were all parking spots. And they just poured a bunch of sand and put a bunch of landscaping. And then the parking was shifted to a different location. Just a great idea. So I share this with you to inspire you to think about some of those opportunities. When you're looking at a resort hotel, it's really important to understand the occupancy and when you're going to be closed and what impact that's going to have on your business. So we were looking at a hotel in Cape Cod, and that thing closes basically the entire winter. So it closes from like October to April. And that's a big chunk of time where it shut down. Some people think that's a great thing, but you have to be able to manage it well. One way to do that, you're going to have to pay your GM the entire year. You're going to have to pay a maintenance engineer the entire year. Everyone else is going to have to be seasonal. Now, you can get J1 workers from overseas and bring them in, but you're still going to need to employ some people in the local town to keep some consistency. So it's something you're going to have to think of. If you can find a property that you can keep open all year round, it's amazing because you'll be able to maximize your occupancy and you won't have the challenges of starting over every single year. Let's talk about programming. And what I mean by programming is, what are we going to put in this motel that we have? Because again, these things were built with very limited public space. So you basically had a little, like, it was like a motel room with a front desk, and that was where you check in. What do the modern versions of these lifestyle motels, we'll call them, need? I think they need a coffee shop. They need a place to get muffins and coffee in the morning and some smoothies and acai bowl and maybe, you know, an egg burrito. They need a bar out by the pool, but you don't need a full food program. Do you need a gym? No, you don't need a gym. Would it be great to have a couple Pelotons on like a, you know, platform outside? Absolutely. Under a gazebo? Absolutely. Some yoga mats, some free weights out there outside? 100%. What if it's cold? Well, then someone's going to have to go hiking. They're not going to be able to maybe work out outside, or maybe they are, but that's a sacrifice that you're going to have to make because you can't take up space inside the motel because you need that to maximize the key count. So I don't think a restaurant is required. If you have the space and you have the business plan that can accommodate it, and you are a food and beverage person, it can be a huge value add. So when you think of Sunset Beach, the restaurant drives, I don't know, I haven't seen the P&L, but I would say 50 to 60% of the revenue, maybe even more. That could be a good thing. It could be a bad thing. But if you have the space and you have the demand in the local town, it could be interesting to consider it. It could also bring you a ton more business because people are coming for this whole full lifestyle experience. You know, Liz Lambert has some really cool motels in Austin. Like, she did the Austin Motel, has a little kind of diner thing out front. Definitely something to consider, but I think you have to have a coffee shop. I think you have to have a bar. I don't think you have to go crazy on the food and beverage. We were looking at this deal, and if we couldn't get a liquor license, we weren't going to do it because we thought one of the real upsides was serving alcohol out by the pool to guests at night, cocktails before they go out to dinner, or just hanging around during the day. Now let's go over kind of, I'm breezing through this. I'm sure there's going to be questions. Let's go through renovation scope and plans. Again, thinking back to what John Grossman said, don't fight the building. The whole charm, the whole nostalgia is these most motel style where you have exterior corridors. You might have like patios that just walk out. You can kind of see in the rooms at the Standard Miami Beach. They have like a big bathtub in the front. Now they're like curtained off and screened off with landscaping. You can't see it, but how cool. You have a little jacuzzi, you have a little bathtub, super romantic, super fun, a great way to embrace the motel design and aesthetic. I don't think you need to expand the rooms. I think you need to put in new bathrooms, most likely, new tile, get rid of a tub, put a shower. You should definitely go wood floors. Carpet's kind of gross. We're doing wood floors in all our hotels, even if it's not wood. They have some really great fake wood that looks really good, that rolls on, that's really durable. You can barely tell the difference. You should really consider that with some area rugs. Don't skimp out on the designer. Hire a great interior designer to work with you to figure this out. But make sure it encompasses the entire scope where you have thought about the branding of the hotel, and that informs, you know, the painting and the coloring and how you are designing some of the exterior and some of the amenities. If I go back to Sunset Beach, you know, all these like yellow stripes, it's just so on brand. It's so good, right? Everywhere, it's just consistent. They have the French bistro chairs. It's all a theme and it needs to speak to each other, but the guest rooms are really, really, really simple. So let me just show you kind of what this looks like from a guest room standpoint, because you're not going to believe how simple these guest rooms are and the rates that they're getting. So let's try and like, look at this room. I mean, this is just simple light wood floors, white slip covers, nothing on the walls. Maybe it's too simple, but look how fun the bathroom is. They embraced the tiles. They got funky. You do not need to go crazy. If we go back to John Grossman's High Country Motor Lodge, what he did is he just painted the exterior of this motel some cool dark gray colors. And that did it for him, okay? I mean, that did it for him. Look at this. And you still see the P-Tex. They painted the black rails. But then you got the lobby. I mean, look how good some of this stuff is. So spend money where you can get an ROI and spend money to make sure that you are creating a vibe and experience and a brand, but don't overspend in the areas where you're not going to get a return. You're always going to get a return on alcohol, I think. So build a nice little bar. I think that's a good use of dollars. What John Grossman does here is he has like a, you know, no touch check-in. Let me see if I can grab a picture of the check-in experience, but there's basically a bunch of kiosks in the lobby right here. So there's a bunch of kiosks in the lobby. And what you do is you have lobby ambassadors, you know, running all around, and they can help you check in, but they can also make you a drink. They can also tell you about the restaurants in town. They can tell you what time the national park opens. They can tell you how to get there, but you check in, you make your key, you do it all yourself. And that's an opportunity to save money and to save space. You don't need the big old school check-in desk. And a lot of these places, you can set it all up with your phone. So you just check in right with your phone, access your door right with your phone. So there's a lot of opportunities to be smart. And there's a lot of kind of tech that you can use that the big brands won't let you lose. But if you have an independent motel, lifestyle motel, you can do it. So that is a great opportunity and a great way to save some dollars. Next, like we'll talk about a little bit, just very high level, how you underwrite these hotels. Base case, you cannot assume the seller's financials are legitimate. You are buying from a mom and pop seller, likely unsophisticated. They likely don't audit their financials. They don't probably have a lot of partners that are that focused. They might have a lender that's asleep at the wheel. Do not rely on their financials. Use them to inform some decisions that you're making and to kind of figure out where things are, but base your financials off of other information that you have from your history, other information that you can garner from the region, and put it together yourself. Do not rely on their financials and bank on them. In terms of underwriting top line revenue, go get a Star report. Not a lot of these small hotels participate in Star, but there will be some. And if your hotel has some scale, like if we're talking, call it 50 rooms to 100 rooms or 40 rooms to 100 rooms, you can likely find other hotels that are comparable in the market or in other kind of drive-to markets that are very, very closely similar. But be careful about that. You know, Nantucket is not Provincetown, Massachusetts, different markets, different price points. So use those types of data to inform how you're underwriting the deal from a top line standpoint, and make sure you are not so aggressive that everything has to be a home run in order for the deal to be a success for you. You want to build in some risk. You want to build in some downside protection. And that means you have to buy it right from the seller. So that comes into the underwriting. The good thing is the staffing model at these places are pretty simple, and the annual costs are pretty simple because you're not part of a brand. So a lot of the stuff you can figure out from other data points, from other deals. And it might be good to take some information from the seller, but again, don't rely on it. You have to fact check every single thing. Potential risks. Let's talk about that. These deals definitely involve risk, but they're typically a smaller check size. So you can oftentimes finance them with a local bank at pretty low leverage. The other nice thing is you're not building a new hotel, so you won't have to provide completion guarantees, and you should probably try and find a bank that won't require you to put up a personal guarantee. If you have to, you know, you can consider that on a personal level and evaluate that. Some other risks that you need to consider are maintenance risk and deferred CapEx. Again, you're buying from a seller that probably utilized a significant amount of DIY construction. So you got to be careful with some of those things that you're getting into. And you got to make assumptions on what you're going to do from a CapEx standpoint and what limitations you might have with the existing infrastructure. There's always a risk whenever you're doing a big renovation or big CapEx. In a renovation project like this, we would always include a 10% contingency, but because the project is maybe a smaller key count, so if you're assuming like I'm going to spend $40,000 or $50,000 a key to renovate this, but you only have a 40-room hotel, well, you're not building yourself maybe enough coverage on your public space, your landscaping, because the key count is smaller versus if you had 100 keys and you could spread out some dollars in the public areas. There's just less to go around on a smaller hotel. So you might want to break out some of these bases in a more specific way. Another risk is that you're an independent hotel. So you're going to have to develop a kick-ass website, kick-ass social media strategy, and generate your own business. Now there's a bunch of groups like, you know, Lifehouse does revenue management for people, but we have our own revenue management team. I think I have 4 people in revenue management, so we do that all in-house, and it's a huge value add for us. But you have to be on top of revenue management in these type of hotels, and that's setting the daily rates based on the demand in the market. And you know, at some of these smaller hotels, the sophistication level isn't always as high, so that's definitely something to think through. Another risk is overassuming opportunities that require input and approval from the city council or governmental bodies. So if your whole business plan hinges on building, you know, 5 cottages in the back, but you don't have any approval and you don't know if it can be done, well, then I probably wouldn't underwrite that until you have confidence in that business plan that it can be executed. If you are opening up a bar and you don't yet know whether you can have a liquor license, don't assume the bar and the liquor license. Those are, you know, definitely some potential risks that we've come across that we've thought about. And the other thing I would say is that the hotel business is really, really hard. It's incredibly hard. It's an operating business. And just because the person you're buying it from might be unsophisticated, might be a mom and pop, might be a little old school, doesn't mean they didn't try to do some of the things that you're doing. So don't assume that everything that you think is low-hanging fruit can be easily achieved. They might have tried that and failed. They might have failed for reasons that they had no control over. So you want to try and figure that out. You want to ask a lot of questions, and you don't want to prepay for ideas that may not come to fruition.
So my family has had a historic hotel in Ohio, about 80 keys, two restaurants, a bar, and a banquet hall, which it's time for. My parents are in their 70s, so one of the things we're talking about is what are the next steps for the hotel. I've reached out. So there's a company in Columbus called Rockbridge Hospitality. Have you come across Rockbridge before?
Yeah, Rockbridge. Jim Merkel's the CEO.
Yeah.
Rockbridge is a big company. They do, I don't know if they manage, but they invest, they develop, they own, they have a couple different business lines now. But yeah, Rockbridge is a great company.
Yeah. So I think one of the things which we're considering is what do we need to do to get the hotel, and this probably more of a revenue size, to start to appeal for an institutional buyer. I mean, I think that they tend to do a lot of the generic key stuff, but then they do have a group called Make Ready where they are expanding a bit more into independent boutique hotels. And my preliminary meeting was trying to get an assessment of what are some of the criteria. And I guess that's why I wanted to ask you, from your experience on the investor side, is there a minimum revenue size or key count, et cetera, that it starts to become appealing, or at least worth looking at from an institutional size buyer?
Well, I'll answer. What did they tell you, though? I'm curious.
They said that the property is a bit too small for them. But obviously, and I think their latest funds are $400 million or $500 million of equity capital. So I can understand that they're looking to deploy in bigger chunks. But yes, also on the bigger side of and there's a universe of investors out there.
So here's what I'll say. 80 rooms is a great key count. It's a great size. And I mean, we were looking at a hotel that's 30 rooms that's doing $1,000 ADR at 70% occupancy. So a lot of these groups, depending on what their strategy is, won't touch hotels below a certain revenue threshold. But the key count doesn't concern me. What I would think that might deter certain groups is the revenue potential. So if you're in a market where the ADRs are incredibly low and you, for whatever reason, can't create a product, not you, but anyone can create a product that's going to attract a customer that's going to spend a lot of money, then it might not be worth the risk, because the amount of money and time you spend on an 80-room hotel doing, I don't know, making up $5 million a year in revenue could be the same as a 120-room hotel doing $20 million a year. So there's definitely a cost-benefit analysis that a lot of groups are doing. But on the flip side, the hotel that you have, depending on like where it's located, how it looks, could be very appealing to groups that are very focused on lifestyle and experiential properties, because you have two restaurants, you have a bar, you have meeting space, you could do weddings. Like, to me, frankly, that's really interesting. Like, I don't know enough about the market in Ohio or about the specific location or about what it looks like, but I don't think that it would deter groups, just on the basis of key count. I think what the big holdup is going to be revenue potential and whether they think Ohio is a market that can attract high RevPAR leisure demand. I think that's probably the bigger concern, and what the other demand generators are locally if you're not creating them at the hotel.
Yeah. Now, I mean, I think where it is right now, combined revenue between the hotel, F&B, et cetera, is in the 2-2.5 region. And I think that that's why our thinking is, if we do a larger CapEx, redo the F&B, if we can push that revenue number closer to 4 to 5 million. But then that's why I'm curious, even at 4 to 5 million, would that get on anyone's radar, or just way too small?
It would get on some people's radar, but it wouldn't get on Rockbridge's radar.
But that's why I also understand.
Yeah, it wouldn't get on any institutional, radar. Like, for example, in my portfolio, we don't have any hotels doing less than probably $9 or $10 million in revenue a year. And I think if you're doing a lot less than that with F&B, depending on who the buyer is, it's going to be challenging. But I also don't necessarily think that Rockbridge would be the best buyer for that hotel anyways. You could probably drive more value with someone who has a better business plan, has more time to devote to it, and go that route. But you never know until you test the market. And it might not be spending the dollars yourself. It might just be letting someone else spend the money, and you know, you already created this base and foundation.
Yeah. And then
kind of look at what your ROI is on that.
Okay. I mean, I have a few more questions, but I'll first let others ask if they have more in the meantime.
Thanks. So I'm Juan Martinez del Campo from Mexico. I came a bit late to the meeting, so I'm sorry if this point was touched before. I heard you mention that, you know, you're an independent hotel. In the example you were giving, you have to have a kick-ass website and kick-ass social media. So as an independent hotel, having kick-ass website, kick-ass social media, is that a way to organically grow your customer base, your revenue, your reservations, etc., to steer away and steer clear from you know, the platforms that eat a chunk off your you know, with their commissions, they take a huge chunk out of it. Is it, in your opinion, is it worth kind of going the independent route at risk of not getting to as many eyeballs, but having a plan to grow and keep that, you know, not pay them their commission, or use the platforms as a way to attract revenue, again, being an independent hotel?
So you need to do all of the above, okay? We have currently, most of our portfolio is all Marriott and Hilton franchised hotels. And we derive business from OTAs, online travel agents, which is like Booking.com, you know, Google, and everyone, right? So because we are part of Hilton and Marriott, we pay around 10 or 11%. If you are an independent hotel doing it on your own, you're probably going to pay around 20%. So we're getting a savings, but we're also paying Hilton and Marriott, and they're bringing scale. That's great. But the more business that you could book directly on your website, the better, because you're not going to pay any commission. So I think a website and a compelling website and amazing photography is one of the best ways to do that. We use a company to create our lifestyle websites, and some of the biggest players do too, called Tambourine. And Tambourine's based in Florida. They're a great company. This is all they do. And they actually charge like a monthly fee. So what's nice is your upfront cost is not that significant, and you could do like constant, you know, updates. But they do a lot of things on the revenue side, on the reservation side. You can track where people are coming from. With an independent hotel, you could do so much more than we could do with Hilton and Marriott. I mean, you can basically like segment your customer. So let's just say you had a hotel in Miami Beach, and you knew that there was a big, huge Brazilian music star that was performing in Miami, and all these Brazilians were coming to Miami to see that concert. You can actually like target, okay, if people are coming from Brazil, their rate's going to be a little bit higher than the people that are coming from Ohio, because I know there's more demand and I know I can charge them more money. Like, you could do all that stuff as an independent hotel. And then for social media, we use a company called, I think they're called C2 Create. Yeah, here it is. No, I guess not. I'll have to find it, but I think it's called C2 Creative. They are a social media company. And let me tell you how we do social media. So we just opened up the Moxie Hotel in St. Pete. So if you go to their Instagram channel, you will see a ton of content, and we have influencers coming to that hotel multiple times a week. and they produce content. And we just open up the rooftop restaurant Sparrow, and we have the same thing. Influencers come. And the amazing thing about that is we get the rights and the hard copies of all of that content that they produce that we can then reuse across all of our social channels. And, you know, these are like really creative people that have a big following because they know how to take good pictures and videos. So you're getting world-class pictures and photography basically for free. You know, you're trading a free night and, you know, free dinners and whatever we're giving them in exchange for that. You should definitely take professional photography that you're going to utilize on your website, but influencers is very, very, very important. And then you can also do targeting advertisements, which we do as well. We use a company. I'll give you this company. Let me pull it up.
Sorry, does C2 Creative bring these influencers? Or
yes, good question. C2 Creative manages the influencers. So like they find them, they send them to us, we approve them, and they deal with all that. Like, you know, you don't want to be looking up influencers online and figuring out if they have a good following. And you also want influencers that are relevant to your market. Like, you know, you don't want to bring someone that focuses on, I don't know, nature travel in Antarctica to your hotel in Mexico. It's just irrelevant, right? So you want the people that are going to take good photos, that are going to have a following, that are going to go to your hotel. And then for e-commerce, we use this company called Mapletree, and they handle all of our e-commerce. That's like SEO, Facebook ads, Google ads, all this kind of stuff. And they used to work for Marriott, and during COVID, they spun off and created their own firm. So for things that we think others can do better, we outsource those items, and we're happy with the results. There's also Lifehouse now has like spun out more of a revenue management side and like a website building side. So they have a lot of experience building independent hotel websites, small hotel websites. So that would be an option. But let me show you like what you're competing against, okay? We came across in doing research in a market, we came across this hotel and this website. So this is the website, okay?
Yep.
I mean, look at, what is this? Like a crappy photo. Like, I don't even know what these lines are. There's cookbooks. I don't even know what this is. Like, you know, there's random pictures, okay, you know, whatever. What bugs me the most about hotel websites is how quickly you can find the gallery. You have to find the gallery quickly. And if you look at all of Tambourine's websites, they like lead in with a video. So any website that they're doing, they have like a video that they are leading off with. And these guys focus on lifestyle and independent hotels. So even if you're not going to hire them, it's a good resource to go see what other people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is absolutely lifestyle, surfer oriented.
100%. So like Lifehouse Hotels. So we can go here. They have a company, you know, work with us for hotel owners. I don't know how I got to, okay, this is another brand that I've looked at before. This is called Lark. They have like these cutesy little motels all around, these little retreats. And, but like already they're setting the vibe and the tone of what you're going to experience. Like you get it, right? It's obvious. Yeah. So hopefully that was helpful.
That is very helpful. And yeah, like as much as we can steer it clear from, you know, the platforms to get, you know, stop getting fleeced. And
yeah, you're getting fleeced, but honestly, you get a ton of business from them. And like, it's not the worst thing. Like, we get a lot of business from OTAs, and people habitually go to booking.com and hotels.com and they book stuff. And, you know, sometimes you can prevent that, but sometimes you can't. So you want to work with them too. We spend a lot of time and effort. I actually rate my revenue team. We grade them for how detailed and how complete our pages are on the OTA websites. And that means that all the pictures must be up there, all the details, all the amenities. Like, we take that very seriously because it's hard to get business and you want as many distribution channels as possible. Now, if you're talking your 5 or 10 room hotel, then you don't need them. But if you're talking, you know, something with 40, 50, 60 rooms, you probably need them.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Everything that you've said has resonated with the exact scenario that we're trying to pursue right now. So my wife and I are located in Denver. We are literally re-offering on a motel in Northwest Michigan. They just changed agents. It's been really hard to communicate with the mom and pop, like everything that you've talked about with the Cape Cod scenario. This is it in a different zip code.
Yeah.
So one, I guess my question is, like, they've shared their P&L with us for the last 3 years.
Right.
Very underperforming asset. They haven't changed their rates, I think, in 3-4 years.
Forever. Yep.
We don't even know like what happened beyond there. So they could be stuck in 1986 for all we know right now. So we see a tremendous upside, but the offers and the conversations that we've had to date, you know, comes down to sale price.
Of course.
So what they've presented from a business opportunity does not support their sale price. So do you have any strategies or suggestions on how we have those conversations through an agent? Unfortunately, like, we can't have direct conversations with the seller, but do you have strategies that we could kind of employ to get to a fair market value based on either what their current business is, or do you kind of have to meet a little bit middle to what the business could be?
So, as of today, I mean, I just failed my negotiation. So my advice is going to come from, you know, experience, but we've also won a lot of negotiations. So here's a couple things that you mentioned that I think are common. When we're buying normal, like, hotels that we're buying that are, you know, $10 million or more, $20 million more, whatever, $50 million, they have a professional hotel brokerage team. And what that company does is they set a broker's opinion of value. And before the property's marketed, and these guys are smart, they sell hotels, they don't waste time, they put together a ton of research. Hotel brokers probably are the hardest working brokers there are, because there's a lot of work that they put in. And they know what they're talking about, and they're not going to take a deal to market unless, you know, it's a reasonable price that they think they can transact at. Most of the hotels that you're talking about and that we just were looking at are being rep by, like, residential brokers. And I'm sorry to say, but these people are clueless. And they are talking about a business like an emotional transaction. 100%. And you guys seem like smart people. And you're not doing this because this is your grandfather's hotel and you want to buy it back for the family and you don't care what the price is. You're buying this for a business. So you're fighting a battle between two different schools of thoughts. I always think it's, like, impossible to negotiate with a middleman. So what I think you need to do is try and get on the phone with the seller. And you could also position that conversation as a fact-finding, due diligence type conversation. And then, you know, work and talk about price. But you're not going to be able to negotiate effectively if you don't know what's motivating the seller. And you don't know kind of the little tells that they might reveal to you in an in-person meeting or in a phone call. Might be worth trying to have an in-person meeting with them, because they might reveal that they own 3 other motels and they need to do this big renovation, or they're doing the renovation. They kind of, like, are running out of money and now they need to sell this one in a hurry, or they need to get whatever they can get and move on from this one and focus on the other ones. You might find out that the parents own the hotel and the kids are doctors in New York and they don't care what happens to this thing. So you have to really understand who you're dealing with. But at the end of the day, if you attempt to let them negotiate against themselves when you're in the room with them or you're on the phone with them, you know, by being silent and by listening, when they kind of start talking price, if they seem very comfortable and they're not really talking about, well, I might consider this or this or that, then you might not be able to negotiate with them and they might be pretty firm in their number. But let's just say you get kind of close. There are ways to structure deals creatively from like a creative finance standpoint that could potentially be interesting. Seller financing is the most obvious and easy. The other one could be like an earnout structure. And we recently proposed this. So let's just say you guys have this big difference on value. And by the way, they might have a difference on value because they have a beachfront property and they're seeing land sell for $1 million, like a lot for residential homes. And they're thinking, well, I've got like five lots, so mine's worth $5 million. Well, unless that thing's going to get knocked down and five houses can get built there, it's not worth $5 million. It's worth what you're talking about, what the business is generating, and maybe some middle ground between what you think you can generate. So Barry Sternlicht, the first W that he did was the conversion of the Holiday Inn Hotel in Chicago. And Barry didn't really pay what the Holiday Inn Chicago is worth. He paid a little bit more because he knew he could make a lot more by converting it to the W, and there's this big business opportunity. So it's not always just like paying them maybe on a cap rate what they're doing. I think there's a little bit of, you know, work that you have to do to get closer to their number. But the other earnout component, you know, that we threw out there was like, listen, we're doing this for business. Here's our numbers. We think that in 5 years from now, if we hit all of our metrics, that this property is going to be worth, I'm making it up, $15 million. Okay. How am I supposed to pay you $12 million right now? It's like, if I only think it's going to be worth $15 million in 5 years. But, you know, don't tell him this, but you can create like what's called a schmuck insurance. So where he doesn't feel like he's getting taken advantage of. So you say something like this, well, if we double our equity when we go to sell it in 5 years, then, you know, we'll give you $2 million after we double our equity. And then after that, you know, we get to keep the rest, or maybe, you know, we'll give you $3 million and then we get to keep the rest. Whatever it is, they can have some sort of an earnout only after you hit a really great return on your equity. Don't do this where if you just like get your money back, then they're getting all this extra money on top because, you know, you took the risk, you put in all the work, and it should be a pretty decent multiple on your money because it's a hard business and it's not easy to do what you're doing, particularly in light of the performance that they're currently encountering today.
Yeah. And you know, the scale of what we're looking at, just so there's context here, is this is a plus or minus $1 million property. It's 10 keys right now. It's got a couple cabins, a little motel feature, a barn dough on it. So we're not quite into the 100, 200 plus unit properties yet. This is a stepping stone.
Like, what do they want for it?
They have it listed for just under 1.2. We put an offer in at 900.
Okay.
And they came back and said, well, we're closer to like 1.1. So at the end of the day, we're 200 off.
Oh, they're negotiable. You got to get them on the phone.
Yeah, well, especially not replying to us. I mean, that's the thing. It's almost like we've completely offended them with our offer. And so they just stopped replying. And
they had a really bad, like, to your point, like, it's a small town in northern Michigan, probably more of a residential broker, horrible, horrible communication. So they changed brokerage firms, but we still have a middleman. Like, your suggestions of trying to get them on the phone to understand what their story is, how can this be a win-win? We haven't succeeded in actually having a conversation with them, which...
We have asked multiple
times. Yeah. So you know what you can do?
Stop again.
Yeah, you know what you can do also is write them a letter and put your offer in writing. Write them a letter and FedEx it to the address of the hotel or, you know, where their mailing address is that owns the business. It's their broker. It's not your broker. So who cares about this person? They're obligated to pay them a fee. And there's no rule that says you two can't communicate. So write them a letter and say, hey, would you be open to meeting? Would you open to a phone call? And if you're that close, you know, you're, let's just say 10, 15% away, you could do something else. You could say, hey, give us a little seller financing for, you know, the $100,000 or the $200,000 at a reasonable interest rate, you know, low, like 6-7%, and we'll pay you back.
Yeah. Those are all good strategies. So, but everything that you've said today, like, this has really resonated to our situation. So really appreciate the information and the conversation. So
hope you guys crush it. Yeah. Keep me posted. Sounds awesome, but get the deal. You're close.
And
they're negotiable. So just talk to them. You'll figure it out.
Help me understand alternative financing opportunities. The quick stories: we've expanded, bought these mid-tier hotels in the range of 3 to 8 million. Most of what's happening is these legacy owners haven't shown good NOI for obvious reasons. However, the bank, conventional way to go about it, banks are not lending on projections. We don't want to go the SBA route. So now we're trying to identify what are alternative methods of getting financing. And why don't you get your thoughts on it?
Okay, so why won't the bank lend on the current income?
Because the NOI is really low. These people, most of the times, are, you know, paying themselves, etc. You know what? So it's just low. Yeah, purposely. And they don't want to see the adjusted. And the second thing is, I've seen there's a trend that regional banks are shying away from the hospitality industry.
Regional banks are shying away from the hospitality industry. I think that's changing. I actually think smaller regional banks, you might have more luck with, but if you lower the leverage, you know, during COVID, and we're doing it now, we have a second fund, we're doing preferred equity. And that's a great way to bridge a gap, because it should be accretive to your common equity. It's going to be more expensive than the debt, but typically how we structure it is, you know, you don't necessarily have to pay as current unless there's cash flow. So if you got like a 50% loan from a bank, you could get up to probably, we'd probably do up to 70% in preferred equity. Now it's expensive, but it's cheaper than equity. It's more expensive than debt. And that could be a way for you to help bridge a gap. Now, if you can't get any financing for whatever reason, then you might have to try and cobble it together with equity or go to like smaller debt funds. There are a lot of private credit. Like, everyone is doing private credit right now. It's just a little bit more expensive. Don't over leverage yourself, but it's definitely more expensive. So that is another way. And then you could refinance it once you have legitimate financials with a more traditional lender.
Thank you very much.
You know, banks can square out the value based on price per key and replacement costs. You know, there's other ways to appraise the property beyond what the financials are. And you could also normalize the financials as well for the bank. So, you know, you talked about projections. Well, keep their revenue the same, if you think that the revenue is legitimate, or show a star report and layer in, you know, the value today based on some of those metrics. That would be how I would try and solve the issue. Michael, what's up, man? The motel man. I was talking to a guy today who buys motels and converts them to multifamily. And everyone was trying to do this during COVID, and they weren't able to do it. And his strategy is very interesting, because the reason why a lot of people screwed up is they were combining units. So they were taking a 100-room motel and making it 50 multifamily units, and it's too expensive. What he does is he just leaves the units and makes them multifamily. It's kind of what you're doing. The nuance, though, is that he's changing the zoning, okay, so that he can now get agency debt from like Freddie and Fannie and basically value it as a multifamily deal instead of a motel and hotel. So there's cap rate compression, but you also get better financing terms. And you can't get agency debt if your property is zoned as a motel or a hotel.
Yeah, that's the goal, and that's definitely what I'm working on, you know, this most recent deal. Though I have so far the three properties kept them as an extended stay, so operationally I'm essentially running them as multifamily, but
yeah. You are
extended stay just because the cash flow is there, but 100% the exit would be multifamily for sure.
Right. You want to make sure the cap rate on exit can be multifamily, and what he was saying is it's obviously easier to do that if they can put multifamily debt on it, and they can do that if it's zoned multifamily. He said one of the challenges is some municipalities have minimum square footage requirements for like multifamily units, like maybe it's 700 or 800 square feet for a one bedroom or something. And obviously a hotel room is like 300 square feet. So you really have to push to get these variances and these things changed to allow it. And, you know, they're a little bit two-sided because they're saying they want all this housing, but then they won't change it and allow for this. So you got to push. But I was thinking about you when he was saying that. So hopefully you're doing well.
Yeah, yeah. Just went on a contract for 140 units outside of Memphis in Millington. But my question, I'm actually closing on a small hotel in Gatlinburg, finally doing the boutique thing for the first time.
Nice. We're looking at a deal in Gatlinburg. I can't tell you what it is, but that's exciting.
Gotta tell me what it is.
I can't. It's like,
you can't come to my home turf and, you know, not give me a ring.
Honestly, I didn't go there yet. We were kind of negotiating through the offer before we went, but
let's connect. You got it. Yeah. Sign whatever.
It's a great market.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great market. Well, so my question was going to be, what's, you know, renovation cost per key should I, you know, budget for 24 unit, you know, just, you know, we want to make a boutique. We're trying to do a Wild West theme. You know, what do you think is a reasonable, you know,
what is a Wild West theme?
So, you know, I'm kind of giving out, you know, some secrets here, but basically I think what works well in those markets like that is something super kitschy and thematic.
Okay.
That gets you to stop scrolling. And I think the 70s theme is like super common, but it's been done here and I feel like it's easily, you know, duplicated. And so I'm just trying to do something different. And like a Wild West, you know, like there's like those Wild West like Photoshop places all up and down the strip. So like that theme obviously sells, people like it. So, you know, I'm thinking like covered wagon beds, like, you know, painted saloon doors on the door, you know, big claw foot tub, you know, with like, you know, you're scrolling with a picture of like, you know, a girl in a bubble bath with like a cowboy hat, you know, just kind of like a kitschy, you know, Wild West kind of theme. There's like a,
I love it.
Bob's cool. Maybe do you like,
so how many keys is this hotel?
Well, there's two parts of it. We're trying to get the other half of it, but right now we're only closing on one of the buildings, and it's 24 units, but hopefully to get the other 20, 30 units, later, but
okay. So
it's to work with,
you know, it's hard. You know, the deal that we were looking at, we've thought $50,000 a key, but I like being over conservative. And so we just renovated, the Renaissance Hotel in Fort Lauderdale. The rooms are beautiful. All we did was the guest room. We didn't even touch the bathroom. That was roughly $17,000 or $18,000 a room. And I think that's a good kind of feel for, we have wood floors, paint, and new furniture, but we didn't touch the bathroom. I think if you add bathroom, that adds $10,000. So now you're at $27,000. The problem that you're going to run into, so let's just say you're at $27,000 a door for 24 keys. You're $650,000. But what are you going to do from an amenity standpoint, from the lobby standpoint? If you say, oh, well, I'm going to spend another $10,000 on the lobby. If you're only 24 keys, right, that's $240,000. But if I'm a 50 key hotel, another $10,000 gets me $500,000.
Yeah.
So you really have to, I think about how much the rooms are going to cost themselves, and then separately budget out what you're going to be doing in the other areas on like a price per square foot basis or something like that.
Absolutely.
And on these old hotels, there's a lot of messed up stuff in the walls. There's screwed up mechanical and plumbing, and it's old. So do you know, so this guy I know owns the Rocky Waters Inn.
Yeah, Mahavir.
Yeah. You know him?
Cool deal. Yeah, yeah, he's super.
So this is a cool hotel, but actually.
Are you doing the deal with him?
Maybe.
Maybe.
But we'll see. And I actually think his website sucks. So I guess here's the issue. Like, wow, beautiful picture. But then, so this is a hotel, and it's like a motel, like along the river, right? And it's like kind of like hanging over the river. But when you're scrolling down, like, you don't see any of that.
Definitely should be the very first
picture. So I'm like bummed out about that. Like, you got to have a hero picture of like the crazy iconic thing. Like, I guess there's this guy hanging out, but like, that's not a big thing. And then when you go to the gallery, I don't really see any of that either.
And this is why I don't like brands, right? Like, you can, look, he's a super smart guy. Like, hey, he's way beyond me. But the thing is, trying to do everything with the autograph collection and trying to be like the soft brand, like, you get too, you just kind of like, oh, the brand's going to give me revenue. Like, they're going to drive me bookings. Like, oh, I don't have to worry about it. But it's like, you know, if you just,
yeah, they don't, like, they bring you bookings, but they don't bring you all your bookings. So
exactly,
you got to work for it. You got to grind. So you're getting into the boutique thing, man. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was, you know, look, I think just because I've been buying all these motels, you know, I'm just getting to know all of the other hotels, and like, just the networking benefits of hospitality are just crazy, because you
love it
with a hotel and they like five of your cousins call them for a deal. So I'm literally just getting like given this deal for free, basically, that he already negotiated. He bought, you know, we're coming in being the operating partner, which I've also
love it. No, exciting.
Yeah, so he's got a great price on it. We'd probably, you know, double our money the day we close. But I think it'll set up for, you know, getting into that. So yeah, I'm starting.
So how are you financing the 140 room one? Like, what's your structure on that deal?
So a couple ways. One is, you know, I think my family-in-law's coming on board on this one. And so just because they're, you know, going to be lending their balance sheet, like, I mean, they're conventional lenders, like giving me like 7%, 25-year AM, like, you know, 85% leverage. Like, I can't even touch that kind of debt when I tried to.
Be careful with 85% leverage.
No, I know. I'm just saying, like, a shot that, you know, they would do that on a
relationship banks, man. If you got the relationship, it's a big value add. So what are you going to do with that? The same deal?
Yeah, extended stays. So it's a Motel 6 Studios that will be deflagging, because I don't like the franchise. I don't like paying that 12%, you know, plus.
Well, but you're not in the hotel business, so why would you do that?
Well, because I'm still doing the extended stays right now. So like, yeah, the multifamily is the exit, but like, I come in and operate it as an extended stay. So instead of keeping like the flag as an extended stay.
Yeah, but your strategy, like, I don't operate an extended stay how you operate an extended stay. We have three extended stays. It's different. Like, you have kind of a very unique approach.
To fit the
yeah, but it's like workforce housing. It's you know, that's what you tell the lender. But yeah, what Michael's really doing is very, very creative and very smart. But it's hard work too.
Yeah, it is. Well, you know, you got to start at the bottom, you know, if you want to be the Jake Warzak of the world. So
I'm not that special. And anytime we've had success, it's all been luck. So, you know, the one thing I actually was telling my team the other day, because our ESOC, extended stay occupancy at some of our extended stay hotels, is too low. And I'm like, you guys need to start posting on Facebook.
Yep.
Because I didn't tell them where I got the idea from, but it's from you. And you need to start posting on Facebook and get in touch with these like traveling nurses groups, and grassroots marketing is key. So I learned from you, man.
Yeah. Hey, likewise. Very, very kind. I appreciate
it. Well, so there you go. So maybe we'll be friends in Gatlinburg.
Yep.
You see.
please.
Well, we didn't go. So if I go, we'll go and send me some stuff on your deal. I think it's really cool. I would love to check it out.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's awesome. I got to hop, guys, but we can do this again. And connect with Michael on Twitter. He's crushing it. And you should see what he's doing. So if you're not following the Motel Man, you should. Hey, everyone. It's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Jay Wurzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Wurzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.